All right, my name is Luke Bentley. Started coming to Rooted last September. I've known people through North Shore. Come with my wife, one of the four Sarahs back there. So today I'll be reading the scripture. We're going into Joshua chapter 22, verses 1 through 12. Then Joshua summoned the Reubenites, the Gadites, and a half-tribe of Manasseh, and said to them, "You have done all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded, and you have obeyed me in everything I commanded. For a long time now, to this very day, you have not deserted your brothers, but have carried out the mission of the Lord your God gave you. Now that the Lord your God has given you your brothers rest as promised, return to your homes in the land of Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side of the Jordan. But be very careful to keep the commandment of the law of Moses, the servant of the Lord gave you. The law of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to obey your God, to walk in all his ways, to obey his commandments, to hold fast to him, and to serve him with all your heart and all your soul." Then Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went to their homes. To the half-tribe of Manasseh, Moses had given them the land of Bashan, and to the other half of the tribe, Joshua gave land to the west side of Jordan with their brothers. When Joshua sent them home, he blessed them, saying, "Return to your homes with your great wealth, with large herds of livestock, with silver, gold, bronze, and iron, and a great quantity of clothing, and divide with your brothers the plunder from your enemies." So the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh left the Israelites at Shiloh and Canaan to return to Gilead, their own land, which they had acquired in accordance with the command of the Lord through Moses. When they came to Gilead, near the Jordan and the land of Canaan, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an imposing altar there by the Jordan. And when the Israelites heard that they had built the altar on the border of Canaan at Gilead, near the Jordan, on the Israelite side, the whole assembly of Israel gathered at Shiloh to go to war against them.
Thanks, Luke. All right. We are having fun this morning. Hey, we're here. This is the final quarter, so to speak. We're in the last 3 weeks of Joshua. This has been pretty cool, I think, for us, and we've got just a little bit left in this pretty incredible book about God's promises and his faithfulness and all that. Let's make some friends this morning. How many of you would say that you are like a conflict avoider? Guys, yeah, avoid conflict. Yeah, I know. I made you raise your hand. How many of you are like, I'll step into that, right? I maybe seek it out. Did you raise your hand twice? Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Ben. We got this really interesting story here that ends with the whole assembly of Israel gathered at Shiloh to go to war against them. Incidentally, the "against them" is like themselves. We're about to have the first ever civil war in Israel's history, which, by the way, Israel's history is like a year old. This is really interesting. So let's do this first. I want to finish the story. We got through verse 12. Let's finish the chapter, and as we go, this is a tool that a professor of mine used to use on us, which we never enjoyed, but it was useful. I'm going to ask whether what these people are doing in the rest of the story was like good or bad, all right, as we journey the rest of the way through Joshua 22. So I'll back up just a little bit. And after we do this, we'll kind of drill in on, there's a lot going on here. There's one really big idea, and that will help with some of these auxiliary ideas. But we read the first half of this. Let's go back to verse 10. If you need a Bible, this will be good to have your own this morning. If you need one, we have NIVs up in the front here. But I'm just going to be reading through. When they came to Gelilath, near the Jordan, in the land of Canaan, the Reubenites, Gadites, and half-tribe of Manasseh built an imposing altar there by the Jordan. Is that a good idea or a bad idea? Well, it seems bad because the Israelites on the west side of the border did not like that. That was verse 11. And then verse 12, the whole assembly of Israel gathered at Shiloh to go to war against them. Good idea, bad idea? Man, some of you don't have any confidence yet in answering these. It's okay, I ask a lot of trick questions. Verse 13, now this is new stuff. So the Israelites sent Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the priest, to the land of Gilead, to Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. With him they sent 10 of the chief men, one from each of the tribes of Israel, each the head of a family division among the Israelite clans. When they went to Gilead, Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, they said to them, "The whole assembly of the Lord says, 'How could you break faith with the God of Israel like this? How could you turn away from the Lord and build yourselves an altar in rebellion against him now?'" Good question or a bad question? Certainly an interesting question. Was not the Nobody's going to be happy by the end of this. By the way, the class where we would read these like obscure passages, and it was a 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. class, and at about 8:45, he would read like, "I the Lord never change," and then he would read another passage where God changes his mind, and he goes, "Is God fair or not?" And it's 8:45 p.m., and we're like, "We don't know how to do this." So hopefully you've had some coffee. So 17, they got a couple more questions, but I don't think as weighty as that first one. Verse 17, "Was not the sin of Peor enough for us? Up to this very day, we have not cleansed ourselves from that sin, even though a plague fell on the community of the Lord." They're talking about stuff earlier in Exodus. "And are you now turning away from the Lord? If you rebel against the Lord today, tomorrow he will be angry with the whole community of Israel. If the land you possess is defiled, come over to the Lord's land where the Lord's tabernacle stands and share the land with us. But do not rebel against the Lord or against us by building an altar for yourselves other than the altar of the Lord our God." Is this a good argument or a bad argument? I think this is a good argument, for the record. Let's jump down to 21. "Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh replied to the heads of the clans of Israel, 'The mighty one, God the Lord, the mighty one, God the Lord, he knows. And let Israel know, if this has been in rebellion or disobedience to the Lord, do not spare us this day. If we have built our own altar to turn away from the Lord, and to offer burnt offerings and grain offerings, or to sacrifice fellowship offerings on it, may the Lord himself call us to account.'" Well, now that's interesting. Is that a good response or a bad response? That one seems pretty legit. And then they expand. "No, we did it for fear that someday your descendants might say to ours, 'What do you have to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? The Lord has made the Jordan River a boundary between us and you, the Reubenites and Gadites. You have no share in the Lord, so your descendants might cause ours to stop fearing the Lord.'" Good reasoning or bad reasoning? And so they unpack that for a few more verses, and then let's pick the story up in verse 31. "And Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the priest, said to Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, 'Today we know that the Lord is with us, because you have not been unfaithful to the Lord in this matter. Now you have rescued the Israelites from the Lord's hand.'" And then verse 33, "They were glad to hear the report and praised God. And they talked no more about going to war against them to devastate the country where the Reubenites and the Gadites lived. And the Reubenites and the Gadites gave the altar this name, 'A witness between us that the Lord is God.'" So there's a lot here, this big extended conversation. We We haven't gotten this level of detail for a while in Joshua. This is more like the first seven chapters. It's been speeding through the narrative for a good chunk, and now there's a lot of back and forth dialogue right here. But if you had to pick a big idea, I know we've just heard the chapter one time. If you had to pick a big idea of what is at stake in Joshua 22, what's being communicated, what is the primary point, what would you guess? Might have some thoughts about communication, about rushing to judgment, about not building altars. I'm going to suggest that Joshua 22 is about how you worship. And it's about the fact that worship is worth your energy. When I say worship, what we really mean by that, when you worship God, you are loving God with structure. Worship is love with form. We worship God on a Sunday morning in some particular forms. We worship God through song. We worship God through the taking of communion. We worship God through prayer. These are just structures, little tangible facets for expressing love to God, for receiving love from God. Preaching is a form of worship. Worship is just love with form, and it's worth fighting for, even if it gets a little awkward. Great worship doesn't just happen. And I think we see at the end of this too, Christian unity doesn't always just happen. So let's go very beginning of the chapter. I think this really helps us understand that this is the primary theme here. If you just start in around verse 10 and you got the conversation, it sure seems like there's a lot about maybe bad assumptions. But look at how 22 started for us. Joshua commends the three tribes who have been fighting for land that wasn't their own. Right? The last few weeks, we've pulled up some maps. All these references to Reuben and Gad and Manasseh, they were to live on the east side of the Jordan. But all of the Canaanites who needed to be driven out were on the west. And so this whole campaign, they were soldiers for a land that they weren't going to live in. And Joshua says, you guys did awesome. You guys supported your country. You were faithful to God's mission. You were one with us. You get to go home. We're done. The fighting is finally over. And then verse 5 is a less famous version of the great commandment that Jesus gives in Matthew 23. It's I'm not sure why it's so much less famous. It's nearly identical wording. Joshua 22, verse 5. But be very careful to keep the commandment of the law that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you, to love the Lord your God, to walk in obedience to him, to keep his commands, to hold fast to him, and to serve him with all your heart and all your soul. So that's the primary takeaway that Joshua gives them. Wherever you guys go, make sure that you love and worship God. You're going to be not next to us. You're going to be geographically separated. If you take one thing from this whole thing, when you're going on your own to a new place, remember this: love God and worship him. And then what follows is this pretty potentially fierce internal fight. This is within the people of God. And immediately, worship has taken on the difference of appearance, or at least the appearance of difference. An altar gets built. So we saw how quickly, you know that phrase, like that escalated quickly. We could say that of Joshua 22. Things get out of control pretty fast. So let me make a couple suggestions. There's a right and a wrong going on here. These are people too, just like us. But the Bible's trying to tell us something about these people and about God. I think what's wrong in this chapter is the communication on both sides. No warning was given, no messenger was sent, no explanation was preempted as to what this altar was from the east. And on the west, they do come to ask what's going on, but they showed up with all their swords. So like the communication is not as good as it could have been. Here's what's right in this chapter, though. They care. They care about the worship that's going to take place. Because I think we all remember that what you care about defines where your energy goes. And as Joshua has already said in verse 5, and I think the rest of this chapter unpacks it, you can influence what you care. You can stoke what you care. And we are called to care about the right things. In this case, it's the worship of God. But in general, what you care about define where your energy goes. I'll give you a couple examples. You may have had an experience for those of you that have found a life partner. I remember the early days with Lauren, and even before our first dates, just talking and then our first date, there's an excitement there. Part of that excitement is, man, the stuff that we care about is the same. Like, I found somebody who's like-minded with me, found somebody who's on the same mission as me, and that was really invigorating. That's cool, right? There's a lot of phrases for that, soulmate and all such of things, but it really was, man, our hearts for Jesus and just some of the other values are the same, and there's a coalescing of energy. It's exciting. Then we've got like neutral and negative examples too about what you care about defines where your energy goes. We have words for these things. What do we call people that appear, or maybe are, totally unmotivated? We call them lazy. Right? Because they're given the appearance that they don't care about whatever it is that you're evaluating. Now, chances are they just might care about something totally different. We have other words, too. What do you call people that care way too much about trivial details? Right? We use words like control freak. But what they care about and the level to which they care is very different than yours. That's why there's a conflict there. Does that make sense? There's this energy. What you care about, what you set your heart on, the things that you've determined in your soul matter. Your energy goes that way. Your emphasis goes that way. In effect, as the Bible would describe it, your worship goes that way. So I don't think it's a huge step to say that the keynote of this chapter is the people's passion for faithfulness in worship to God. And this is really good. This is actually a good example for us on both camps. That part of the example from every person in Joshua 22, good example. And we can learn from it. They're doing this because they love God. And incidentally, because they've read their Bibles. So the strong response from the people on the West probably was influenced by things like this that God has already said. In Deuteronomy 13, there were some really interesting words about worship of any other kind. And so God's speaking to Moses and to all the people. If the prophet says, let us follow other gods, gods you have not known, and let us worship them, you must not listen to the words of that prophet or dreamer. The Lord your God is testing you to find out whether you love him with all your heart and with all your soul. That prophet or dreamer must be put to death for inciting rebellion against the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt and redeemed you from the land of slavery. That prophet or dreamer tried to turn you from the way the Lord your God commanded you to follow. You must purge the evil from among you. So there's an explanation of something that might happen. There's this emphasis that God has about being turned away, and then this really strong, I mean, the tribes on the West, they're just doing what the Bible said. They're like, man, if you're trying to cause us to worship a different God, or if you're trying to do worship differently than what God said, we got to get rid of you. To oversimplify this idea, what the tribes on the west are taking away from this passage is one altar, one faith, one people, not different, one God. They've already heard that, Deuteronomy 6. One God, one Lord, one faith, one altar. If we allow people to start haphazardly worshiping God wherever they like, however they like, it's soon going to take on the flavor of the nations that we just spent years driving out. God specifically said, get rid of that because it will cause your worship and your affections to turn away from me. And they're afraid that if this is allowed to be, that the worship is soon going to take on a Canaanite flavor, soak up Canaanite belief, sport Canaanite practices, eventually worship Canaanite gods. And either God will ruin them or they'll ruin themselves. And so action. I had a front row seat to a few unfortunate journeys doing youth ministry and college ministry. And you know, there's this spiritual version of Rome wasn't built in a day. The journey from somebody, the journey of kids that I watched to leave the church, to leave the faith, it was never an overnight thing. Never. Not one time was it just wake up and I'm out. It started with a small distancing from true worship. And I had a couple of really painful and really unfortunate conversations with people about, man, I think what you're doing is dangerous. I think that church that you're getting really excited about, it's not biblical. I think that group that's calling you in, they're saying some really powerfully addictive and false things. And not every one of those conversations yet has resulted in how this one ended. End of Joshua 22, this is a good ending. This is what we want. This is unity and biblical resolution. And that's awesome. And sometimes that was able to happen and sometimes not. But it's not a tidal wave of one day. It's a slow drift to this gets allowed, then this gets allowed, then this gets allowed until, does God really say that? Is there really only one God? Is there really only one way? So let's take this real and let's take it not that extreme for a moment, but maybe more day-to-day conversations. You may have experienced, has anyone in your life, has any Christian in your life ever told you specifically something not to read? Maybe something not to listen to? Maybe a teacher not to listen to. Maybe a church not to go to. How did that make you feel? First reaction, sometimes those are not what you want to hear, right? What the heck are you telling me what to do? Go away. But hey, a lot of that probably depends on the spirit in which it was given. But there might have been something biblically to that. There might have been something there. Where somebody who cares about God and cares about you wants to speak into your life. So we get dropped into this fight. The Western tribes are arguing that unity cannot exist with apostasy. But the Eastern tribes are arguing that they're afraid that faith is not going to exist without unity. And so I wonder for us, do you care? What do you care enough to fight for? And is it the right thing? What do we learn from how deeply these people care? The relationship dynamic here is an entire nation. I don't have that kind of influence. Chances are you probably don't either. I'm not going to drive to Eastern America and tell them something about how they run their church and have it, you know, go anything like this. But we have some spheres of influence where maybe there are some things that we can draw over the circles that we are part of. And it starts with our own heart. So let's say it this way, and this is again going to bring us to the beginning of this chapter. Love God enough to order your life. Joshua says it in verse 5, love the Lord your God, and we've heard this before, with all your heart and with all your soul. Not half-hearted. How does one grow in their heartfelt worship of God? I think sometimes that feels like a mystery, but biblically it's really not. We have the awesome ability to hear the gospel and to preach the gospel to ourselves through the forms of worship that God has given us. And they're even in this verse. Love the Lord your God. Walk in obedience, keep his commands, hold fast to him, serve him with all your heart and your soul. Did you hear those verbs? And they're different. It's not just a throwaway paragraph all saying a bunch of words to say the same thing. That's some really cool stuff. Learn the commands, walk in obedience. I like, to hold fast to him. I think of growing and being dependent on God. And then service. This idea here, and I think something that Joshua is saying, Augustine founded this phrase of the disordered life or the disordered heart. And he says at the heart of discontent, at the core of discontent, what people are really experiencing is a disordered love. Because we were created for this type of experience. We were created to love God with our whole hearts. But in our sin, we are so quick and so often to mess up the order of priorities. And we get a little bit out of whack with what we love and where our energy goes. And suddenly realizing, man, I've spent more of my week focused on my job, how much money I can make, and I've spent so little time on depending on Jesus. And in God's grace, you can do that and wake up the next day, and you can do it again, wake up the next day. But over time, the disordered life has an effect on all of us. We have a different phrase now, like you are what you eat. And what that does not mean is if you eat broccoli, you are broccoli. But what that does mean is over time, the types of things you eat have a significant impact on your body. It's not any more complicated than that. And so in a very similar way, you are what you love. What you choose to love, what you strengthen as your love, begins slowly but very steadily to define who you are. And so before any type of conversation with others, it starts with ourselves. But then it does come to others. And there's a lot of relationship here. And so the second thing I think Joshua shows us, love your family enough to fight for their worship. Love your immediate family. Some of us love your extended family enough to fight for their worship. We saw a bit of that. It was kind of buried in the middle, but verse 27, when the eastern tribes were explaining why they did what they did, and they said, on the contrary, this is verse 27, it is to be a witness between us and you and the generations that follow. Then we worship the Lord and at his temple with our offerings and all that. Then in the future, your descendants will not say to ours, you have no share in the Lord. They were afraid that the fracture of relationship was going to cause this rift. And so they were actually fighting for a unity in worship between their families. They cared enough to do something bold, to actually set something up, to remind them and their kids and everyone that would be associated with this area, with these tribes, with these families, we actually together worship one God. And in the conversation from the other side, we learned some stuff too, that the West comes passionately focused on the truth. They say, hey, this altar thing, what's it for? What is its purpose? What's that target? What is the object of your worship? Is it Yahweh? Passionately concerned about the truth. Joshua 22 declares for us that it is actually truth that unifies the people of God. Apart from truth, there's no unity. And so God's people here declare their witness through this memorial to the truth. And the end result is unified worship. I think America gets this one backwards a lot. When we talk unity, I think the first thing, because I've had it and I have to wrestle against this a lot, the first thing that comes to mind when we think unity is not causing a fight. Unity is, I will agree for the sake of unity. I will allow for the sake of unity. I will ignore for the sake of unity. I will be peaceful for the sake of unity. All of those absent of truth are wrong. Biblically, that's not what unity is. That is not unity among the saints within a church. It is not a unified church whatsoever if they're all being nice to each other, worshiping 15 different gods. You're not what are you unified around? Your niceness? Biblically, it's about the Lord. And so, for our families, that element of truth becomes really, really important. A lot of us have young kids. A lot of us are in, and a bunch of you guys have already gone through that journey, and thank you for your examples. But there are just innumerable things in our world that disciple us, and by extension, disciple our kids. The most prevalent and most powerful right now is your phone and the whatever's on screen. For the sake of their souls, for the sake of what is being preached to us out of Joshua 22, I do not allow my kids to just watch anything. I do not allow my kids to just be discipled by anything. I actually care about them enough to fight that battle. And I say, this is on the table, but this is not. And we have to do that to ourselves as well with what we watch. But I think there's a unfortunate reality in our world, and at least this has been our experience. We say no to more things than we say yes to, just because of the sheer abundance of what's available. And I mean shows, but also books, but also, any sort of information that comes in, there's so much of it in our world. So much written, so much digital. We end up saying no to more than we say yes to. Fighting for the purity of worship of our family. Again, this starts with us, and so there's another sense too, because there's so much out there that we have to verify our own sources of what goes into our own hearts. You could find almost any sermon from any pastor in a technologically rich country in the whole world and just start listening to preaching. But man, it might be, there's a whole spectrum of what's out there. And again, loving your family enough, loving God enough to fight for that worship. Now, here's an interesting thing. This is not in Joshua 22, but it's biblical. To fight does not always mean conflict. When Paul uses the word fight throughout the New Testament, it's the Greek root of the word agonize. Agonize, that's right. Good job. To strenuously contend, as it gets translated in Colossians. That's like working out. That's like going to war against laziness. That is putting in the discipline to care about what goes into my body, my mind, my heart, my eyes. Doing positive things over a long period of time because it's worth the effort. And I'll just say this, because the world we live in, men, lead your families. Because it's easy not to. It's more comfortable and it's easier to coast and let our wives do things. To run devotionals, to be the primary engine in worship. And I would just say, men, lead your families. And it goes both ways, but I think too often we could give not a rip about what our spouse is doing in their worship life, but if they load the dishwasher wrong, oh man, you're going to hear about it. Right? Where your energy, where what you love determines where your energy goes. So why do you care more about that than the worship of your family? There's a high calling here to care and to specifically train what you care about. Now, there is this dynamic here, east versus west, and they show up in a powerful way in verse 12 to go to war against them. And I would say again, the effort was right, even if maybe the method was wrong. But let's consider this. Love your church enough to be curious. So I think verse 16... we read that. The whole assembly of the Lord says, how could you break faith with the God of Israel like this? How could you turn away from the Lord and build yourselves an altar in rebellion against him? I think that was a bad first question. That's making a lot of assumptions. It wasn't, what have you done? It wasn't, tell me about this altar. It wasn't, what is this? First question was, why'd you give up on Jesus? Not a great first question. But what was really good was, let's go find out. Because they actually did bring a delegate to go ask more questions and to go find out. They came in a little hot, but I think for us, remember way back, who are the conflict avoiders and who are the conflict not avoiders? I don't know. By the way, we're all liars because we all do both when it suits us the most. There are some things that I'll have a fight with anybody and I will stand on that ground. And then there are other times where I just totally shrink away. We all do it. But there's an invitation here to have enough gentle conviction to guide people to center around truth. And to not adopt the mentality that's so powerful in our culture of anybody can worship any way they want. That's actually not true. Or it's not biblical. There are some differences, for sure. And we actually see that because what this thing is that they built, clearly the tribes on the west would not have done that. And it didn't make a lot of sense to them at first. And they were confused by it. That worship was a little different. I don't like the way you guys, I don't like the liturgy of your guys' church. That's weird. But then they learned about the God that they were worshiping within that different structure. And they said, hey, we can get behind that. So there's totally some differences. But there's got to be some unity over truth. The commentary that I'm leaning on a lot for this series from Dale Ralph Davis, and it's cool, it's actually called No Failing Words, which is a phrase that showed up for the first time in chapter 21. And it's going to show up again next week, I think. But from Dale Ralph Davis, out of this chapter, he comes away with a really interesting thought. The church is not a democracy. We love democracy. We love individualism. But he said, the church is not a democracy. Eclectic pluralism. Oh, this is a view that many people will believe. Eclectic pluralism, even in essential doctrine, is to be allowed and even expected. And what he means by that is you get any church on any street in America, and eventually people start coming from all over the place, and they bring this little bit of thinking and that little bit of thinking, and that's just totally normal, right? Man, you get a good, healthy church together, and people are going to believe all kinds of things. Isn't it amazing, the diversity of God? He says that should not be the case. There's so much good diversity in how we're gifted, the ways that we worship. One of the first things we did as this church was the 9 Spiritual Pathways book. And a couple people bought that book. And we talked about the primary way that you connect with God may be totally different than the primary way that I connect with God. I mean, some people like silence. Some people can't stand it. Some people like outdoors. Some people just want to read. Some people just want to talk. Totally different. As long as it's the same God, same theology, same truth. And so my approach with this kind of thing, something's come up, what do we do? My approach is typically this. If you see something questionable in your church, go with questions. I've heard too many people talking kind of around something that they've seen in the church, and they're like asking everybody except the source. They're like, man, what's that? I don't like that. Did you hear that? What are they reading over there? This is crazy. If you see something questionable in your church, I think it is your honor and responsibility to go with questions and to learn. Not go with swords. But go with questions. Because the conclusion of this near catastrophe is awesome. And this is what we would hope for in all things. That there's now a witness between us that the Lord is God. And the source of that witness was truth. They said, we're actually trying to make sure we're worshiping the same God. So, are you willing? I mean, here verse 12. The whole assembly of Israel gathered at Shiloh to go to war. Are you willing to go to war for the sake of unity over the clarity of the gospel? Not literal war. But are you willing to fight the fight against your own heart and your own sinful tendencies to a disordered life? Misplaced priorities, half-hearted worship, to fight that personal battle? Are you willing to go to war for the flourishing of your family? Not everything goes, not laziness, but learning to cultivate a family of worship. And are you willing to go to war for the unity of your church? Not with swords and spears, but with questions. So that ultimately there might be even greater worship. Man, I understand. I have learned from them even. What I thought was questionable actually was beautiful. Let's go to war. God, thank you for this story for us. And in the midst of confusion and miscommunication, and just even in there, we appreciate, God, the realness of how you work through people who we don't always know what to say and sometimes blunder our way through things. But God, how about this example of people who have put at a very high priority worshiping you rightly and worshiping you well? Help us to grow in that. That the list of things that we care about more than worship of you would grow smaller and smaller each day. Till you're at the top. Thank you that though we are made different, in some cases very different, we are able to unite around the gospel that Jesus Christ is Lord. Let that be the source of our song. Let that be the source of our energy as we worship you. In your holy name, amen.